love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation. Or there will never be a single drop of blue. You won't have no freedom, yeah. Got to come together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Feather, or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah, got to realize that we are one.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. 40 years or so, and sooner or later I'll get this intro right. Our guest this morning, Brenda Clough. Stay tuned.
It's here, the great come and get it day. Everything we ordered from Shears and Robust. Idle poor become the idle rich. You'll never know just who is who or who is which. Won't it be rich when everyone's poor relative becomes a rocker fellative and palms no longer itch? What is which?
Joneses from your rafters.
Let's toast the day we drink that drinky up, but with the little pinky up.
The day on which the idle poor become the idle rich.
When a rich man doesn't want to work, he's a bon vivant.
Yes, he's a bon vivant.
But when a poor man doesn't want to work, he's a loafer, he's a lounger, he's a lazy good for nothing.
He's a jerk.
When a rich man loses on a horse, isn't he the sport?
Oh, isn't he the sport?
But when a poor man loses on a horse, he's a gambler, he's a spender, he's a lowlife, he's a reason for divorce.
When a rich man chases after dames, he's a man about town, a man about town. But when a poor man chases after dames,
he's a bounder,
he's a rounder,
he's a rotter,
and a lot of dirty names.
Become the idle rich.
You'll never know just who is who or who is which.
No one will see the Irish or the Slav in you, for when you're on Park Avenue, Cornelius and Mike look alike.
When poor Tweedledum is rich Tweedledee,
this discrimination will no longer be.
When we're in the dough and off of the nut,
you won't know your banker from your butler.
Let's make the switch. With just a few annuities, we'll hide those incongruities in cloaks from Abercrombie Fitch.
Where the idle rich? Where?
Something sweet, something sort of grandish sweeps my soul. When thou art near, my heart feels so sugar candish, my head feels so ginger beer. Something so darish, so I don't care-ish, stirs me from limb to limb. It's so terrific, magnific, delish, to have such an amorish, glamorish dish. We could be, oh, so bright and groomish, skies could be so bluish blue, life could be so loving bloomish, if my ishes could come true. I'm so cherché la femme.
Why should I vanquish, relinquish, resist, when I simply relish this hellish condition?
I might be mannishish or mousish, I might be a fowl or fish, but with thee I'm Eisenhowsish. Please accept my proposition.
You're under my skinish, so please be givinish, or it's the beginnish of the finish of me.
The proof that Yip Harburg and I've forgotten the name of the fellow who wrote the music for Finian's Rainbow, but Yip Harburg, it was really sort of a homage to Gilbert and Sullivan away. I mean, just that something sort of grandish and this-ish and that-ish. Wonderful song. Two songs from Finian's Rainbow. No, it's not necessarily the kind of music that I often play here on Hour of the Wolf, but since we have out-of-town visitors who are going to be attending Broadway later today, we hope, and they'll see what's available at TKTS. We were talking Broadway music. We're going to try to get them into a little night music, which unfortunately I didn't have with me. I carry a hard drive, got lots of music on it, but I don't think that I have other Sondheim. Mm-hmm. I always have to have my Sondheim, but I don't have that. And as far as I know, the cast album of the original cast, which I saw in the current production, the Trevor Nunn-directed production of Little Night Music, I saw it with Catherine Zeta-Jones, who was far better than she was in the Tony Awards. She was awful on the Tony Awards. I mean, her version of Send in the Clowns was worse than Elizabeth Taylor's, and that's saying a lot. She was sick or something. When I saw her on Broadway, she was just fine. And it was with Angela Lansbury. And what can you say other than it was with Angela Lansbury? I mean, that's enough reason to go see any show, anytime, anywhere. Whoops. Don't hit the mic, Jim.
Forever.
Really. Exactly. So, but now it's Elaine Stritch and Bernadette Peters. And it's almost tempting to go back just to see it with them. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Yes, I've got good coffee this morning. That's why I'm talking weird. And do you like it, Brenda?
Yes.
Is the coffee all I advertise in email?
It's delicious.
Yeah, I like it. It's delish, as that song said. And before we get to our show this morning, it is time for me to do my promotions. I actually only have the one. And that is, now that we've taken a long, long break, that was 1 month, of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, we're back this coming Tuesday. You're not still in town on Tuesday, are you? No, no, I didn't think so. But I almost just anointed the console with coffee. It's what you're not supposed to have liquid in this room. But I do. You see, it would have been a two-month vacation, but in July, Paolo Bacigalupi decided to come to town, and I couldn't not do a reading with Paolo Bacigalupi, who my guess is going to be win the Hugo Award tonight. Is that are the Hugos tonight or tomorrow?
It's one or the other. No, but haven't they already happened?
Friday night? Now, it's in Australia, so
right.
Friday night could have
I think it's already happened.
Really?
I think it's already happened.
Hmm.
You should check.
Yeah, I can do that at some point. But I
can't remember how the international dateline works.
No. It can't be. No, it's right now. It should be Saturday afternoon.
All right, then in
late
that case,
Saturday. I know because during the making of The Two Towers, I had a couple of special effects people who were editing the movie on the air live from New Zealand. And it was like, you know, mid to late afternoon. Well, it was a Varg team in Hour of the Wolf here.
Okay, so, well.
So.
Okay.
So actually, probably in just a few hours, because I think it's usually Saturday night.
Yes.
And that they give
7,
out
8, 9 p.m. by the time they grind it all through.
Oh, well, geez. The nebulas this year were endless. For four awards, were you there?
No,
You didn't go to Florida? We had an assemblage of people at the same place where I do the readings. There was an assemblage of people watching it on there. And we had Nora Jemison with us. We had one nominee with us. And she was in the first category, short stories. And from when the banquet began to the announcement that Keege Johnson won in that category, which nobody's saying she didn't deserve to do, but it was excruciating for poor Nora. And it was 4 hours.
Well,
the Hugos give out like 25 awards,
right,
plus
the Seon Award, the Big Heart Award, and on and on and on and on.
Well, they were doing that kind of a thing. They gave out different, the Andre Norton Award,
right,
and things like that,
right,
at the Nebulas.
Right. There's a long, long list of like minor awards rolling
but
around.
But for the Nebulas, there are only like four or five of the minor awards.
What was it that sucked up all the time? Were they long speeches and thanks, or were they
lots
of waiters rolling around with trays?
There was that for the first like 45 minutes, but then they had this.
I know you have the elections, the officers.
They had three awards for editors.
Oh gosh. Okay.
Okay. And each of them got their thing. There was the Andre Norton Award, which Kat Valenti won for.
Right.
A best juvenile or young person's novel. And then a writer, David Levine, got up and basically did what I did on my summer vacation for about half an hour, in which he discussed, you know, what it was like to be with NASA and pretend you're on Mars. It was a fine event, but not for the Nebula Awards.
The reason I'm interested in this is, you know, the Nebulas are coming to Washington, D.C. next year.
Oh, are they?
They are. That's another reason you need to think about this. And one of the things
whenever I can get to the Nebulas, I do.
Well, apparently it's going to be in Washington, D.C. next year. And the argument is that rather than moving it round and round from place to place every year and essentially having to reinvent the wheel, they're going to try to keep it there for a couple of cycles.
Oh, that would suit
A, me. You save money by cutting a multi-year deal with the hotel, and B, you get a team of people to actually learn how to – you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can just make that wheel roll from year to year.
Something tells me that this is Mary Robinette Kowal.
Well, actually,
this smart thing.
What is fatal? The
and
reason,
maybe Scalzi.
The reason why this is so pertinent is I live near Washington, D.C., and I know who's behind the eight ball.
You're a Beltway girl.
I am behind the eight ball to
as
some extent with this. You know, everyone in Washington is going to get, you know, we're going to have to roll on up there and put our shoulder to the wheel in annoying and irritating ways.
Well, the Nebulas, of course, always used to be in New York. They alternated right. between New York
and the
LA.
West Coast. And that made sense because there was a long period of time when essentially if you didn't live in the West Coast or the East Coast, you know, you were living in flyover country, all five of the members who were living in flyover
country.
And
let's point, you know, two basic things out. SFWA, SFWINS are the Science Fiction Writers of America.
Who hold the Nebulas every year.
Yes. Basically, the publishers are here in New York.
Right.
Duh.
Well, but on the other hand, publishers like to travel too, and so it's better not to go to St. Louis or Arkansas or Kansas City.
Publishers, editors, they don't have the budget.
Well, now they don't have the budget. Now they don't.
They didn't really then either.
Well, you could argue it with L.A. because of the whole movie racket.
No, L.A. is fine.
Yes, but Washington, you can take Amtrak. You can take the bus from Chinatown for, $29.99?
And die.
Well, they have Wi-Fi on that bus. You should give it some thought. Chinatown to Chinatown bus?
Yeah.
Well, you give it thought. Anyway.
I will give it a thought. I have given it thought.
Amtrak.
No, thank you.
Amtrak or nothing.
Metroliner. No, actually, I'll drive. Thank you.
Well, you could do that too. And you know,
Barbara and I will drive.
Well, I'll tell you that this year I expensively redid our bathroom in my house. So I'm good for house guests now for the Nebulas. For however many years we do it. Okay, I'm good.
There you go. You know. But you didn't want to announce that on the radio, by the way.
Well, that's okay because, you know, you're already booked, you know, for that weekend. Okay. So it's full, man. You know?
I'll have to talk to them because what I did the last time the Nebulas were in New York, which was 2007.
Right.
I held court, which is that they gave me a small little room off of the con suite.
Oh, you could do commentary, live commentary.
No, thank you. I have no interest in covering the awards. I just invited everybody present to come in and record an interview for an hour.
Good. That's
and
a good
I got... I got about 10 great shows out of it.
Well, you have to give that some thought because there is a lot of
But I'm not taking one of those Chinatown buses.
If you're bringing equipment, your car, frankly, is the way to go because it's a.
Oh my!
You know, you don't want
to. My equipment fits into a little Crown Royale bag, which is what I carry it in.
Good. All right.
No, but that's not the issue. It's read up on the safety and issues of the Chinatown buses.
Okay.
Just, you know, insurance issues.
Driver issues. I speak as a person who drove up in a minivan. I've drove from Washington to New York in a minivan.
Yeah.
So, I don't have to worry about it.
And also just pollution issues. One of the major issues is how they take up all the streets in Chinatown. Very narrow.
Oh, yes.
They park illegally.
For hours. With the engine running.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the issues of how bad the drivers were and stuff like that is over with. Although the New York to Boston run, which was the original Chinatown run here, was really problematic, and they've straightened that out. Now there's also something like the Zip Bus or something like that. One science fiction and tech writer person, Daniel Dern, has traveled to and from Boston for $1.
Oh, my gosh.
And I don't know how they do that, but they do it. And apparently that's a safe service. And, yes, they have Wi-Fi and all that. You know what? I'll still stick to...
If you have a car, you know, we're Americans, are we not going to drive?
Also, I only just learned to drive about, you know, 10 or 11
years
ago.
You're a true New Yorker.
I'm a bona fide New Yorker. It's New York. Why do I need to bleep and drive?
Well, you know, it's actually better probably for you to not. You don't really need to drive in this city, you know.
You really
if
don't.
If the car is a handicap, I have to have it because I have to drag I have to bring back a 12th place setting of China from New York to Washington. So I had to have a vehicle. Amtrak, impossible with 12th place setting of China.
Coming here and leaving here is fine. Mm-hmm. But when you're living here, where
it's
do you
impossible.
Park?
day to day to day. No, it'll kill you.
I live in a place where we can park easily and all that, and my partner, she has a car and all that. So at that point, why wouldn't I learn to drive?
It's good to know to drive. You know, it's the Robert Heinlein thing. You should know all of these basic life things. It's good to know how to sail. It's good to know how to stanch a wound. It's good to know how to deliver CPR. You never know when, you know, something might happen and you would need to know how to do these things.
Yeah. So let me finish the intro so we can actually start.
Oh, well, good.
The intro being this Tuesday, that's where I was. We were talking about the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, where the Nebula Award, New York version of the Nebula Award reception was held. But this coming Tuesday, they have some cool event tonight, by the way. You have to go to their website, just Google up the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. They're having like a steampunk reception from like 4 to 7, 4 to 8. It's a launch for a party, a launch for a book, rather. It's a party launch for a book. It's not free. It's not free, mm-hmm. but it does sound way cool.
Can't make
and,
it.
And, but I think it's Michelle Lange's new book from Tor. But I'm not sure about that. At any rate, if you go and Google that up, you will find out more about it. But my event is this coming Tuesday. And it is, as always, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We are beginning our 21st season.
Wow.
And Gordon Van Gelder started it in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct, 1989. Or 1990, depending on if we're relying on Gordon's memory or Claire Wolfe Smith's memory. Claire is probably right, but I already held the 20th anniversary season, so this is going to be our second 20th anniversary season, okay? Or it's the 21st anniversary. I don't care. What we have is we have two people named Langan, okay? Mm-hmm. That's it. It's a double Langan feature. Sarah and John Langan. No, they're not married. No, they're not brother and sister. In fact, they're not related. They just happen to be named Langan, and they just happen to be two wonderful writers of dark fantasy. John Langan, I'm going into official mode. John Langan has been called an emerging master of the elegant macabre. He's author of a novel, House of Windows, which came out from Nightshade, and it's pretty new, actually, and a collection of stories, Mr. Gaunt and Other Easy Encounters, which was from Prime about 2 years ago. Nominated for the Bram Stoker Award and the International Horror Guild Award, he's published stories in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, the anthologies Clulu's Reign, from Daw. Oh, okay, that's just coming out. By Blood We Live from Nightshade. Poe, edited by Datlow, of course, Ellen Datlow, from Solaris Books. And The Living Dead, edited by John Joseph Adams, again, Nightshade. Forthcoming work includes stories in Ellen Datlow's Blood and Other Cravings, Tor 2011, and Supernatural Noir from Dark Horse. Next year. He teaches courses in creative writing and Gothic fiction at SUNY, that's the State University of New York, in New Paltz. And he lives in upstate New York with his wife, son, and two cats. Sarah Langan, both of these people have been on the show, by the way, for those who are faithful listeners, is the author of three novels, The Keeper, The Missing, and Audrey's Door, and dozens of short stories. Her fiction has been translated into 10 languages and optioned by the Weinstein Company for film. It has also garnered three... It has... Oh, yes, her fiction. Okay, yes. Copy editing, even while live on the air. It has also garnered three Bram Stoker Awards, and an American Library Association Award, two Dark Scribe Awards, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Pick, and a Publisher's Weekly Favorite Book of the Year selection. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband, daughter, and rabbit. And Amy Goldschlager will host this event, and I am, of course, executive curator and producer of the event. So it is, what didn't I print out? What I didn't print out is where it is. Okay, so you know what? I am going to make sure that I have it in front of me because I don't want to misspeak the address on the radio. It is the Soho Gallery for Digital Art online. That is sohodigart.com, SOHODIGART. And 138, yes, I would have said it right, 138 Sullivan Street. That is between Houston and Prince Street. And it is this coming Tuesday. Doors open at 6:30. Event begins at 7. And admission is free. But we will cajole you for donations on your way in, because, well, you know, we run it like we run WBAI. It's free, but please give something. Otherwise, in this case, otherwise it comes out of my pocket. So, and we try to buy dinner and drinks for the readers. That's, you know, that's what the money really goes to. So if you think that John Langan deserves a drink, and we certainly do, then you want to.
You could buy him one.
You could buy him one, because, oh yes, and if you come, you get to go out with us. We all go out together after the reading. So, so that's it. There we go. Thank you. Now I have done my promotional deed, and we've wasted half an hour already. Good morning, Brenda.
I'm awake. Excellent. Awake. Coffee.
Yeah.
Coffee.
Yeah. Coffee. Coffee. We should tell people who you are. I haven't done that yet. Not really. Brenda Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H, Brenda W. Clough, actually, and mm-hmm. when one looks that up, is well, you're a wonderful writer. Short stories, novels, multi-disciplined in multiple genre. I'm not looking at anything. I'm just, how do you like to describe yourself?
I'm just a very creative person. Did I it's tell you true. I'm not doing some book covers?
No.
Yes. So it's I've been doing a lot of the book covers for Bookview Cafe, which you can see at bookviewcafe.com.
Which is an amazing, wonderful website.
It's a cooperative of writers, and we are publishing fiction online, not only backlist stuff, but original stuff. So if you go to Bookview Cafe, all the book covers, many of the book covers you see that are original to Bookview Cafe, I don't know what you're looking at there, but the...
your website.
Is that bookviewcafe.com?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm looking at your website.
Okay. Well, I don't think the covers are there, although I suppose I should transplant them over at some point.
I can go to Bookview Cafe. I'm seeing the blog.
Yeah. Oh, Bookview Cafe has the... If you see the Brewing Fine Fiction, Red Cup... with the words coming out of the top of the coffee cup, I painted that. And so there's I've been doing it's an interesting experiment, tinkering with book covers. The issue, of course, when you're producing, yes, when you're producing your own e-books, you have to have a graphic, because otherwise people don't buy things. You need to have an image that you have the rights to. And the easiest way to do that is to make it yourself out of nothing. And then you do have the rights. And, you know, you can't just copy pictures off of, you know, newspapers or stuff, because then you don't have the full clear possession of the image.
Mm-hmm.
So this way it's perfectly lovely and nice. And it's quite cool. And we do. We've got a couple of original anthologies. I think the Brewing Fine Fiction is a collection of short bits of about the writing life and how to write. And so, what with one thing and another, we've got a good bit of up there. People could look at it.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about your writing. How would you sum up yourself as a writer?
Well, I'm versatile.
Very.
Well, I write fantasy. I write science fiction. I've taken a fairly sharp detour into steampunk recently, mainly because someone at Bookview Cafe said, well, we have to do a steampunk anthology because it would be so
fun.
By
the way, I hope you notice that you're drinking from a steampunk mug.
Yes, I see this. The steampunk state of mind mug.
Which is a radio drama from ZBS.
Well, we're going to – we've done one steampunk anthology – titled I think it's A Shadow Conspiracy. It should be there. And then we're going to do another one, which I don't know what they're going to title it, whether it'll just be number two or whether it'll have a totally interesting, more thrilling title. But this, it's a sort of a shared world, I guess. And the basic premise of it is that George Gordon, Lord Byron, is a evil and dangerous person and Aww. Has done many, many quite evil and exciting things. And
he was evil and dangerous.
Well, he was bad and dangerous and to know, as his contemporaries alleged. And so, we've put a little, given him a little backstory on this. And so there's a vast fun. Everyone just leaps in and digs around and has a very good time.
Are there zeppelins? It's not steampunk if there aren't zeppelins.
Well, we have sex bots. Won't that do? Sex bots. What more could you ask for? Nice zeppelins. Automatons.
No, sex bots on zeppelins. That's...
Well, that's difficult to manage it at that point if you're really going to have, X-rated activity on top of
zeppelins.
Difficulties.
Yeah. And that helium can really...
Right. So there's there's just so much we can have just so much fun with this. To have a whole group of writers rooting around on this, you can pass ideas around and around, and we'll say, so you are doing a castle full of love robots. I could use a couple love robots, and so ideas can roll around and around. And a good time is had by all, and so it's very, very pleasing and exciting. And I have, I think on Bookview Cafe, I have a completely original novel that's not available anywhere else there, and it's titled Revise the World, and it is about the exploration of Antarctica and the Scott Expedition.
I was looking for a copy for this morning of Sinfonia Antarctica by Ray Vaughan Williams, which is wonderful.
It is actually, it's somewhere on the internet. There are websites that solely revolve around Antarctic exploration. I think it's up on one of them.
Well, it would be copyrighted.
Yeah. But it is, we do a lot of...
And I want proper,
Yeah, you've got to do all these, touch all these bases. So we've got a lot of different things rolling around. The nice thing about a cooperative on this, the idea with this is to get ahead of the wave and on the new media. It's almost better to do it yourself than to try to have a publisher do this. It's almost communist. We're seizing the means of production for the workers are now going to own their tools of production rather than being the...
So writers can make their marks.
Well...
I'm sorry.
Yes, it's going to be just so... We're just going to have to see how this works out, but it is... it's kind of exciting and fun, and it allows us to get out from the having to funnel it through your publishers.
I just had a really sick idea. You know how everybody is doing, taking classic stuff and adding vampires and zombies?
Right,
to
right.
I just got
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Well,
or whatever.
I just got Zombie Home Companion by
Harrison
Giller.
My God. All right.
And, The Stories of Lake Wobegotten. That was it.
He's going to be enraged. My God. Okay.
It's rather
lame.
I didn't say that, but it's definitely it's from Nightshade. It's definitely complimentary. So I just had an idea from what you were saying with the communist thing and all that to do it the other way. Take a Swedish vampire movie, which are going to be remake in America, and add communism to it, and you have Lenin the right one in.
Go right ahead. Go and do it. You go.
There you go. So it's a mashup the other way. You start with the vampires and you add literary.
Go right ahead and do it, man. There is a... I personally think the whole vampire and zombie thing is going to run its course any moment now, at 20 minutes or so.
I can't wait.
I shouldn't say that.
Some of my best friends make their living through vampires.
I do feel, though, that this current mashup thing, Jane Austen and
the
vampires...
Oh, I really hope the mashup thing is over.
Yeah, this is like enough. We've pounded that joke into the ground and it is flat.
And it's all that it was a joke. It wasn't even writing.
No, it wasn't. I don't think that... So I personally think that you can stick a fork in it and say it's done. But I don't know if everyone else agrees. For all I know, there are people out there saying, please, more, give us more.
Well, they keep coming out with them, which means that somebody's paying for it.
Somebody's buying. I don't know. You know, but you know,
and you know what it is? Is that I took a look at the Lake Wobegon version, and I have to say the cover is fabulous.
It has to be because that's frequently the main.
But that's it. That's it. Past the cover, past the title
to the words
and the cover. I mean, I wouldn't mind having those, like, you know, in a collection on the wall. I don't need to read them.
Right. The joke only carries you as far as the cover.
Yeah.
And that is, it's the same with the, you know, I guess Pride and Prejudice and Zombies is the one that comes to mind.
And it was the one.
Yeah. And so there's a limit to how far that will go. I think that is done, but no one's asking me, you know, or you either. Someone's grinding these things around. But soon, very soon, the fashion will completely pass.
But the vampire thing is utterly fascinating. It's the why and the nuances behind vampires and all that. And she who created this radio show, Margot Adler, has been on, where's that place she works? Oh, NPR, yeah. what's the name of that show? All Things... Whatever, you know, she left this show to do All Things
Considered.
That's it. That's what they call it. Yeah. You know, she wants a slum. Let her slum. Margot has, in the last year, gone on. She's read over 125 vampire novels in a row. And she has been covering this on NPR as she reads these books.
And they're different ones, right?
Oh, no, yeah.
I wouldn't have thought there were 100 vampire novels in the obviously there are.
There are well over 300 or 400 easily. Okay. And that's probably just being published this year.
You're not talking about Carmilla and Dracula and that
well,
kind
we,
of
yes,
thing.
Well, yes, we are.
Okay. Yeah, well,
if it's a vampire novel, then she's reading it. You know, she started with the Polidori.
All right.
But she's also doing the Laurel Hamilton.
Oh, right. And there's Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough. And by the time you suck through all of those, there's probably...
The Laurel Hamilton alone account for 15 books.
Right. Okay. Well,
and
there you go.
And L.A. Banks.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, later on, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, in late October, near Halloween, black vampires.
Okay.
Black writers with their vampire stories.
That'll be very good.
Including L.A. Banks and Terrence Taylor and Elia Don Johnson and my curators for that event are Terrence Taylor and Sheree Renee Thomas. So, I mean, you know, you don't get better than that. But anyway, just thought I'd mention that, you know. So, yes, I will ride that wave a little bit. And there's a very interesting thing there about black vampires and the... Mm-hmm. subcultures and all that.
Voodoo and it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So let me ask you, it's already 5:42. Let me ask you an interview question kind of question. So, being an Asian American, does that inform your writing at all?
Well...
I know everybody who hears the name Clough knows immediately that you're an Asian American.
Well, I blame my husband on that one, you know, but there... Actually, I have a short story in an anthology. It's Derek Mack and Eric Choi did a Daw anthology, and it is all Asian. They were going to be all Asian American science fiction writers.
Really?
And mysteriously, it's called The Dragon and the Stars, so it should kick up somewhere if you put it into Amazon.com. But it actually turns out to be all Chinese American.
Not just Asian, but Chinese.
Well, it just worked out that way. And so there's a whole bunch of.
I would love to do a show on that.
Well, you should talk to him. If you're going down to Cap Clave, I think Derek is going to be there.
I am supposed to be at Cap Clave.
Yeah, and you should talk to Derek about it. He's actually up in, I think they're up in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not that far. And they come down here to do various stuff. And with this thing rolling around, you just never know. You know, there's a lot of different things that we could do with it. But that one is just out, I think.
And you have a story in that?
Yes, and it is... It is steampunky, and it is the one about an evil Asian plot to invade England, and it's a cunning stunt. So you'll just have to go and read it there. But it is
you must say that very carefully.
Yeah, it's a common. Well, I like. Luckily, I can get away with these things. It's going to be great.
But yeah, no, I was just saying, no spoonerisms.
Yeah, yeah, very complex here
in front of the FCC.
Please. Right, right. So anyway, it is around, and it must be in bookstores and stuff, and so that's something that people could look at.
Yeah.
One of the DAW anthologies that they do. So that's very nice.
Okay, I'll have to get in touch with the DAW. But I haven't spoken to anybody at DAW for a long time, and I love.
Well, they're right here. So
I could walk over there.
Right, exactly. Walk over there and pry copies out of them.
Yeah. Well, it's not just that. And say, you know, say hi.
Right.
But I think the last time I saw them was I went out to dinner with them when Tad Williams was in town with Otherworld first came out. That's like, you know, 15 years ago.
Right. That is kind of too long.
It really is. It really is. Well, you know, it's already getting on to 4:45, and you're going to read something for us. And I'd like to leave time after the reading.
Mm-hmm.
So should we take a break first?
Maybe
a brief music break.
Yes, that's not a bad idea, and then we will read.
Well, why don't I? You mentioned sex bots, so why don't we put on a 1929 song about sex bots? You don't know this one.
It isn't Let's Misbehave.
No.
Okay.
First of all, that's about 1926.
Okay.
First of all, and second of all, that's not. There's no sex. That's just Cole Porter. That's a whole other realm of sexual
innuendo.
But this is possibly, well, we're still in safe harbor. This is Winnie Leitner, one of the stars of the Ziegfeld era.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Oh, you know, Mr. Blake, I'm going to like you an awful lot because you're my weakness now.
Of machinery, you walk in a beanery, you drop a nickel in the slot and get a bowl of pepper pot. That's how you dine today. There's the airplane and radio and the talking picture show. Everything's electric. Mechanically we fly and ride. We'll soon make love that way. I want a mechanical man.
Winnie Leitner, Mechanical Man. I don't know where that's from. Obviously, that particular recording seemed to be from a movie, but yeah, you know, don't let the batteries fail. You're what, Max?
I know it. I've seen that movie.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of it, but I've seen it.
Okay, yeah, well.
So it is a movie.
Oh, it has to be a movie. I mean, you heard the dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. It'll come to me.
Yeah, no doubt. This is, by the way, as you can tell by our complete professionalism, WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and otherwise available at WBAI.org, available to the universe that way. And the program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Brenda Clough, who is going to be reading for you very shortly. I should mention, next week on this show, Barry N. Malzberg will be the guest, as he usually is the second Saturday of every year. He missed last year, which is the first time in years and years and years that he missed one because of leg trouble. Wow. And we are all at an age... he's no spring chicken. But Barry will be here next week, and I'm very pleased by that. The week after that, yes, we had like six guests last week from the from Sybil's Garage, the magazine, and all that. But then we will have a writers group. This is something that I do in the show about twice a year. Altered Fluid is the writers' group, and they come here and they do what is the Hour of the Wolf version of a reality show. One of the members of the group reads the first draft of a short story, which the others will have read in the week just before broadcast. Then that person will read the story live on the air, and then everybody else in the group, there's about 10 people in the group, get to critique the story.
That's very educational, you know.
It's very educational. It's also, I can't imagine being a writer and being subjected to that live on the radio. I mean, it's difficult enough in an actual writer's group to have your friends and peers dissect. And not necessarily, they're not unkind.
Do you let the author participate in this and suddenly break in and say, no, they were not doing this?
They have a whole methodology. Right. Each writer's group is different. Do you belong to any writer's groups?
I run one for the Writers Center in Bethesda, Maryland. Ooh. I do a fantasy and science fiction workshop, which you could sign up for at writer.org. But the when we do it there, we're careful to have the author, the writer has to keep his mouth shut.
Yeah, well, that's what happens.
Because otherwise, you know, if you were reading it in analog magazine, it's not like the author could phone you and say, you know, over here on page 39, I just want to mention that wearing his clothes at that moment or whatever.
Exactly. What they do here is everybody is timed, depending on how long the story is and how much time we've got on the air.
Good.
2 to 3 minutes. Everybody makes a comment. If other people agree or disagree, they say ditto or undito or whatever.
Right, and you don't go into minutia like here on page 39, there's a comma missing.
Yeah, no. It's about the story. It's about the characters. Good. How could you do that? Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Or it wasn't clear to me that this theme gelled with that theme. They're going for the big macro stuff.
Right.
And then after everybody has picked apart the author's ego,
the author gets to come in and say, you completely misunderstood how I was. It was all an analogy for the American capitalistic system and it's corrupt, whatever.
That's exactly what happens.
Right.
And then we open.
That's always fun.
I mean, can you imagine? So that's
That actually could be good because then the listeners could support you in phone calls and disagree with the critiquers, you know.
Yeah, also very educational for people who want to learn how to write.
It absolutely is, and to participate in a group
I'm
like that.
I'm fascinated by this.
That's why people do this because then you realize if 4 out of 5 people had no idea that your symbolism was intended to be a critique of socialism in the 1929, then you have failed to communicate with your reader.
Exactly.
In my workshop once, we read a short story, and in this short story, it ended in a ambiguous way. It wasn't clear what was happening. It seemed to be that the two characters were having sex on a beach, but you could also read the text and argue that he shot her and threw her body into the ocean.
Ooh.
Okay, now what that was, you understand it was unclear writing because it certainly should be one or the other. It cannot be both. We could not. At the text and we could not figure out exactly which it was. Finally, I put it to a vote. We had I think we had like seven people in that writers group at the time, and the author, of course, was out. We voted. It was split 3-3. Yeah. Whether it was murder or just really energetic sex. And the poor author was sitting there, and finally when it was her turn, she said, but how could you believe that? I don't even remember which it was, but she said, how could you believe it was one or the other? It was so clear in my own mind that it was this one.
That's exactly it.
And then at that point, we said, it's obvious. You didn't communicate it clearly. You need to rewrite to force it to one side or the other. It shouldn't be both.
I will try to make it very brief, but I saw a Broadway show. It was based on the show was Grand Hotel, the musical, Tommy
right.
Tune musical,
right.
Based on, I didn't know the movie. I had not seen the movie.
Right.
And there was an important thing at the end, and the guy doesn't show up at the train station.
And you had no idea what the hell was going on.
I didn't know why the guy didn't show up. And Barbara, my partner, says to me, he's dead. He was killed. That's not obvious. It's like, no, it wasn't obvious. And I asked, and everybody I spoke to said, well, of course, it's absolutely, utterly obvious. I found one other person who had seen the show who did not know the movie, and they took it the same way I did.
Well, it is fatal to do that. And that's the sort of thing, frankly, that's very easy to fix. If the producers had known that, they could have just a brief reference.
They could have had an offstage gunshot.
As simple as pie, it would be to fix it. But if you don't know to fix
but
it, you cannot know.
But it was all
to
in their
it.
Head. It was so obvious. It didn't,
right.
You know.
Right.
So it was
fatal.
So apparent.
Fatal.
And, yeah. Exactly. So.
Well, it is. That is the whole purpose between groups like that, and it is the service that it gives to the. Your writer is almost incomparable.
So we will be doing that live on the air in 2 weeks. The reader this time will be Kay Tempest Bradford.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a wonderful writer and a fascinating, to call her a dynamic personality. She's the only person I know who actually battled Harlan Ellison in email and won.
Oh, okay? My God.
So over a person of color issue. And she beat him down. It's very difficult. Well, you see, now he's going to hear that I said this. Okay, anyway.
And maybe you take the phone off the hook now.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, it's going to be my private line. He knows too much about me. And vice versa. So just remember that. Okay, so anyway, and then in 3 weeks, I have a conflict. It will either be Graham Slight live or Nalo Hopkinson recorded. I need to figure out how we're going to do this. Whichever it isn't, it'll be the other, like the week after, okay? So so that's enough preview of what we have in Hour of the Wolf, because we have now with us Brenda Clough, who's going to read. And so instead of talking about the future, we should deal with the present, something many science fiction shows don't but should do.
Well, this story is titled The Maiden Mechanical, and it was written for the Bookview Cafe anthology, which isn't out yet, but it is about
okay, but I will ask you, since this is reading, not just conversation, don't move the mic, pull the mic so that it, you know what?
Hang on.
I'll just break all radio
right.
rules.
Okay, hang on. I'm pulling it.
Well,
here.
Just sit like
okay.
as if you're going to read.
Okay, and I'm going to read it.
Adjusting. There we go.
Okay, I'm going to read it. The title is The Maiden Mechanical. Brass gears chattered, and the dumb waiter trundled a leather-bound book up from the library depths. Mike saw the gilt title clearly. A Year in a Den of Iniquity by a Footman. He congratulated himself, searching on the word Xanadu, but excluding Coleridge had been exactly right. Once again, the famous steam catalog had made good. Just as the mechanism shunted the book into reach, another hand darted in and snatched it up. Young man, this is the Babbage Institute of Mechanismic Sciences. You can have no business here. Mike ground his teeth. On his short, skinny frame, his new black academical robe did look like a borrowed disguise. I am a Cambridge student. First year, I concede, but admitted early for my engineering brilliance. I need that volume for my research. And you are what, 13? The librarian's gelid eye behind the pince-nez assessed Mike's hairless upper lip and his chin, free even of peach fuzz. I am almost 15. Too young to have access to a work of this nature, the librarian declared. He clutched the volume to his chest as if to hide even the title from Mike's virgin gaze. Far, far too young. In Christian decency, lad, I must shield you from the moral pitfalls of this work. Come back when you're 20. No, 30. Suppressing his fury, Mike turned and made it his escape before the librarian could up the age to 35. You'll thank me for this someday, the librarian called after him. Dear Lord, these humiliations would not happen if only he had achieved puberty. And to cap his misery, here at the bottom of the library steps were Monthly and Whitgift. The two upperclassmen had shed their academicals in favor of boaters and blazers. A large wicker picnic basket waited at their feet. Ready to embark, ho-ho, Monthly drawled. The hated nickname made Mike wince. Without reply, he flung off his own gown and followed in their sauntering wake to the banks of the Cam. He was in for it now. A late tea on the water was the aegis for their true destination. It was a convincing ruse. Michaelmas term was the most clement season for boating in Cambridge. The punt worked upstream, with Monthly on the till expertly managing the pole. Sheep and cattle grazed on the backs between the noble stone facades of the college buildings, and the rhythmic drip and splash of the pole was conducive to dreaming. Once past the village of Grantchester, Whitgift opened the basket and dug out a split of champagne. Mike was not offered a glass. He knew how it looked, a pair of aristocratic athletes taking the new boy out on the water. In actuality, his loathsome companions were invigilators, watching to ensure that Mike followed through on his rash promise. When they pulled up at an old stone curb on the further bank, Mike climbed out without a word and began to hack uphill through the thorny underbrush. The looming wall of Xanadu was invisible behind the thick growth, but they all three knew it was there. Sweat ran down Mike's pale forehead, and the briars tore at his trousers. Was there anything at all, more stupid than this sophomoric precedence display? He should be able to sneer at these snobs. Their comments about NTS, not top shelf, should not sting. He paused to mop his brow and practice that sneer, curling his upper lip. What could be done to accelerate his long-promised growth spurt? Eat more? Lift dumbbells? Being skinny and small, in addition to being young and brilliant, was like wearing a paper target pinned between his shoulder blades. No length of leg, however, was going to help him with this ruinous wall. The last undergraduate had tried a frontal assault and been nobbled by the mechanical at the gate. He hadn't been sent down, but his broken head had achieved the same effect. Mike deduced the wall was the way in. No one had maintained it for years. Oak and ash had taken root right up against the ramparts. Mike picked his spot and easily chimney walked up between a tall trunk and the crumbling brick. From this vantage, he could scramble onto a slanting roof beyond. Slates, black with moss, shifted and cracked under his boots, and he had to climb up on hands and knees to distribute his weight. At the top of a slippery slope were broken windows, tall voids of darkness. He could make nothing of the interior. Surely the floor could not be far below. Again he congratulated himself. Brilliant forethought to bring a coil of stout hempen rope. Perhaps it had not been completely wise, though, to carry it looped diagonally over his shoulder under his jacket. Removing the garment and the rope was tricky, on his knees in the gathering dusk on the slick, broken slates. The window mullion was strong enough to bear his weight as he shinned down. But, damnation, here he was at the end of the line, and there was nothing beneath his reaching boot toes. Four ells of rope should have been enough. What was this place, a cistern? This was where the book Den of Iniquity would have helped, to give him an idea of the layout of Xanadu. He had to return with a souvenir, a proof of his penetration into the sanctum. Perhaps a different window would give on to an easier chamber. With a crack of aged wood, the mullion above gave. As he dropped, Mike instinctively curled like a spider whose line is cut. He fell, only a yard or two, into a deep drift of leaves, years' worth, piled up on the floor. Crisp and dry, Their noise and the crash of his fall seemed to make the darkness echo. He lay very still, catching his breath and listening. There were no humans in Xanadu anymore. But what machine watchers had he waked? For a long, long moment, there was only the rustle of settling leaves and the patter of sawdust sparkling as it fell in the shaft of light from the broken window. Mike was just telling himself that all was well when there was a distinct chink of metal behind his left shoulder. Very carefully, trying not to rustle, he peered over his shoulder into the gloom. It was Stygian. "Who's there?" he demanded, his voice a hateful treble squeak. Another clank, and the groan of a long unused hinge or gear. Mike jumped to his feet. He had no weapon but a penknife. He would have to run. But to be pursued through a dark, haunted castle by an unknown terror was the stuff of nightmare. "I'm a scientist," he told himself. "I will at least identify this death machine." And then, into the shaft of dusty light, stepped a girl. She was an automata. She must be. But her slender arms, her dainty heart-shaped face, all cried out youth and innocence. "Please," she whispered, "help me." She swayed and fell, but he leaped to break her fall. Yes, she was too heavy to be flesh. He could feel now the grate and grind of the mechanism in the reed-slim waist under the mildewy fabric of her gown. "What? Who are you?" "I'm Elena. Please, help me." Of course I will. You may rely upon me." He gazed down into her huge blue eyes and knew he was lost forever. There could be no regulations against mechanical servitors at Queen's College, not with its reputation for engineering brilliance. The college buttery was even staffed by one, dubbed Erasmus, after a noted alumnus. However, Mike knew that there would be an almighty dust-up if he displayed an automata formed like a comely young female. And if it got out he had liberated it from Xanadu, it was bad enough that Whitgift and Muntly knew. The sight of him, emerging from the ancient gate with Elena on his arm, had stunned them into a deliciously respectful silence during the return trip downstream in the gloaming. But Mike had no faith that this happy state of affairs would continue long. In the meantime, there was work to be done. Elena's unknown fabricator had been a master, but Mike knew he could repair her. Her power cells could be rejuvenated, her joints aligned, the pressure seals renewed, the eidolonic manifold seated properly. He spent every waking moment working on the tests, scamping on lectures, missing tutorials. It was like a vigil for his knighthood, consecrating himself to a life in her service. He had never been so happy. "I've never met a girl like you." He knelt before her as she sat in his armchair, adjusting his goggles for the best view. He carefully directed the welding arc onto the broken ankle strut. "I should hope not." She had shed the mildewed rags of her gown and appropriated his mouse-colored dressing gown. "Oh, Mikey, take care. You might burn me. You can feel the heat? Amazing. I wish I could see your nerval diagrams. You will find me very dexterous. It runs in the family." "You are a respectable lad, I can tell. Who are your people?" "Country squires from Yorkshire," he said absently. He pushed his goggles up and reached for a hex screwdriver, which she passed to him. "My parents are dead, but I have a younger brother." "So you know no girls at all, really?" "I shall not need to now. It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief, that thou, her maid, are far more fair than she." "Ah, I played Juliet in the speech room." So cunning was her fabrication that he could see the dimples leap in her cheek as she declaimed. "How camest thou hither, tell me, and wherefore? The orchard walls are high and hard to climb, and the place deaf, considering who thou art, if any of my kinsmen find thee here. You are a romantic. Only if it is romantic to learn to explore you, my America, my newfound land." "You do?" Her blue eyes widened. "I would love to be your America." He hid his blush with chatter. "Your facial engineering is beyond anything I have ever seen. Erasmus downstairs doesn't hold a candle to you for subtlety of expression. And your ankle here. You are familiar with the design principle, that the parts that get the most view and use are the better made. And yet your ankles are as precisely machined as your face. Do you know anything of your maker?" "No, I fear not. Eidolon design is quite beyond me. Suppose you recite more poetry to me instead. I adore poetry. Mike blessed his tutor for forcing him to memorize verse. His little brother had entirely rebelled at the discipline. Elana, he said, rolling the syllables on his tongue, thy beauty is to me as those Nietzschean barks of yore. Oh, Lord, not Poe, that American hack. Noel would kick him down the stairs. Some other versifier, if you please. It was at moments like this that he remembered she was an automaton. Some slight unevenness in her data cards, perhaps, would account for the shift in her tone and speech. And who was Noel? She had a history of which he knew nothing. But all would be well. He would fix her up until she was perfect, and then he would keep her forever. A maiden mechanical. The perfect companion for a young genius. Quickly, he switched back to the proven favorite. 'Twas love who did first prompt me to inquire. He lent me counsel, and I lent him eyes. I am no pilot. Yet, wert thou as far as that vast shore washed with the furthest sea, I would adventure for such merchandise. And, Juliet to his Romeo, she smiled again. Mike was sound asleep, fully clothed and shod, on the sofa in his study. Alana, of course, had the bedroom, when he was jerked awake by a pounding on his door. Let me in, boy! Dr. Poston, what are you doing here? Dragging you to your lecture. Do you know you have missed two? And your paper on differential gearing was due on Tuesday. Research, Mike squeaked. A major project? Tosh! You are here, among other things, for a solid grounding in theory. Even a pupil of your caliber cannot just absorb the higher physics by osmosis. Here, your gown. Let us be off. But... Before he could plead illness or an epileptic fit or a severe hangover, Mike was hauled off. As he stumbled down his stair, with Dr. Poston's large hand on his shoulder, the door of the ground floor study opened a crack. Oh, hell, Whitgift was awake. He gave serious thought to tripping up Dr. Poston in the quad and escaping, but another don joined them and he was trapped. The lecture, by a visiting Italian professor on the energetical properties of phlogistic fluids, would on any other occasion have enthralled him completely, but with Elana unguarded in his rooms, he was unable to concentrate. The moment he could get away, he raced back to the quad, his black gown flapping behind him. He burst into his study and breathed a sigh of relief. It was empty, just as he had left it. But then, from the sleeping chamber, came a giggle. He tapped on the door. Elana? Go away, ho-ho, we're busy. That was Whitgift's voice. Mike turned the knob. It was locked. But these lock sets were as old as the college and the jamb of ancient wood. A hard kick with the sole of his booted foot just beneath the lock plate broke it in. You leave her be. The two upperclassmen clutched at clothing. Muntley was down to his drawers, and Whitgift had nothing on but a shirt. But it was the sight of Elana that made Mike gasp. She was standing on the mattress of his narrow bed, and she had not shed the dressing gown, but it hung open. Between the long lapels, her body gleamed like the inside of a shell, pink and white. "Gentlemen, you do not know what you are about," he began. "Oh, don't we? Ho-ho, you're a bantling. Go away, we'll explain the biology to you later." Mike forced a laugh. "Ha! Munford, this is no automaton. This is a real girl, a human soul transferred into a machine casing." "Good God!" Whitgift stared at her. "That's not possible." With contempt, Mike said, "Talk to her, instead of just admiring her charms, and it's obvious." "Mikey," Alana said, "you are so smart. It's entirely adorable." He had the situation in hands now. Mike shut the ruined door neatly behind him and strolled over to stand with his back to the fireplace, his hands clasped behind him, prepared to crush his foes. "Anyone could see it, Elana. You are widely read and obviously well-educated. Unusual for a girl of your period, which I judge is at least a generation ago. You spoke of acting in the speech room. That is a well-known venue for drama at Harrow. Your connection with that school might simply be through a Harrovian brother or father. But after assessing the glory and cunning of your engineering, I trust you are aware that your Eidolonic manifold is a thing of beauty. I would make a larger surmise. To draw a bow at adventure, I suggest that you were born the daughter of one of the great Harrow engineers, probably a master at Drury's. Some tragedy or illness, you have an aversion to flame, I note, forced him to save your life by transferring your soul into a machine. This is illegal. He was thus forced to maintain you in the shadows until his demise, at which point He set his lips in a grim line at the thought of her transfer to and life in Xanadu. As with slaves, your illegal status, unfortunately, allows your exploitation. Whitgift, Munford, only your ignorance of her true age and station can excuse you. Judging from the appearance of the automaton, carefully he did not glance at her mons veneris, exactly at his eye level and as hairless as his own crotch. She cannot be more than 12 years old. 12? Sweet Jesus! Blanching with dismay, Whitgift shrank back. Munford snatched up his trousers. A revenant! Dear heaven! But, to Mike's utter horror, Alana flung off the dressing gown and hopped off the bed completely nude. Mikey, you are so amusing. I wish I could take you to my club. Without a scrap of shame, she stood before him far too close and patted his cheek. Which blackballed me long ago, alas. This body was specifically crafted to look like a nubile girl. I myself am no such thing. With a distant agony, Mike forced his gaze up and away from the jeweler's perfection of her budding pink nipples. Indeed, the parts that got the most viewing and use. What are you, then? Well, now that is a good question. I attended a public school, as you so cogently reasoned. My name there was John. Oh, God! Oh, my God! Whitgift seemed about ready to faint. A man! I yearned to see what it was like to be female, and my fellow Harrovian, Noel, was able to satisfy my curiosity. Modern science allows one to do so many things. But, do you know, if you switch bodies often enough, it does get confusing. Noel, Mike almost whispered, better known as George Gordon, Lord Byron. The poet king! Munford snatched up a pointed fireplace poker. Chaps, this thing is a monster, created by a monster and a traitor. It is our plain duty to disable it, instantly. Quite right, Whitgift said. They both glanced at Mike. He made no reply. It should never be necessary to reiterate the obvious. Callow schoolboys against me. At Harrow, this John had evidently been trained in Baritsu or some other combat discipline. Elana's slim hands had a machine's speed and strength. One swift twist, and Munford yelled with pain. She's broke my arm! He reeled back. The poker thudded to the carpet. Taller, and a cricketer, Whitgift would have the strength to wield it. If Mike supplied a distraction, at the final crunch it took brains as well as brawn to win the day. The creature had admitted that body hopping clouded the mind. Hugely libertine propensities were a weakness to exploit. So, Mike said, you are a modern Tiresias, able to answer the question of the ages. Which sex enjoys Congress more, do you mean? Elena's smile was as pure as an angel's, a fearful contrast to her words as she turned to face him. My research into the question has been extensive. Behind her, Whitgift, good man, soundlessly reached for the poker. Mike clawed to recall his Shakespeare. Did my heart love till now, forswear it, sight, for I ne'er saw true beauty till this night. He realized he was making an offer to John, not Elena. There was no Elena behind that heart-shaped face, only this unnatural chimera. He forced the words out past a rising gorge. I have always wanted to emulate Columbus, an explorer of strange new lands. What words a teacher longs to hear. She seized his hand before he could draw back and pressed it to one shallow, perfect breast. Every nerve, each drop of blood in his veins seemed to focus and orient itself towards the shattering sensation of that artificial flesh under his palm. He could not imagine what his face revealed, a thundering confluence of lust and revulsion, perhaps, but she laughed at what he could not hide. If love be rough with you, be rough with love. Prick love for pricking, and you beat love down. Mikey, dear, to be your America. Mike had forgotten that Whitgift also fenced for the university. Instead of bringing the poker down on the automaton's head, he thrust, as with the saber. As the point pierced her naked back, the automaton shrieked thinly. The power cells in her abdomen suddenly breached with a ferric object, exploded. The concussion knocked them all flat and blew the windows out. A white-hot fireball expanded in an eye blink, igniting the bedding and the carpet. Whitgift! Whitgift! Mike grabbed the man's ankle to pull him clear. He almost fainted from the shock when Whitgift's head stayed behind. Flying metal had beheaded him better than any guillotine. Near the wall, Mundford, he bellowed for help. The entire room was on fire. In nothing but his drawers, he was going to be badly burnt. For that matter, Mike's own gown was already alight. He dove through the blaze and dragged the injured man up. There was no time to find the door. He hoisted Mundford out the broken window and jumped out after. Better the fall than the fire. 2 weeks later, Mike had graduated to a walking cast and crutches and was past fit for punishment. He hobbled from the college infirmary to the dean's office with great difficulty. Disdaining his death, Dr. Whitty leaned over Mike's chair, a huge dark eagle in black clericals under a billowing doctoral gown. The dean had been Archdeacon of Barchester Cathedral before taking up his responsibilities at Queen's College. He wielded both a priestly and an academic authority that in combination was absolutely terrifying. His sermon lasted nearly an hour, with Mike as the sole member of the congregation. Mundford, as you know, has been sent down, but in consideration of the Whitgift family. Whitgift's grandfather was Archbishop of Canterbury, you may recall. No mention is being made of moral turpitude or gross immorality. Mundford will not face prosecution. The dread name Xanadu will not be pronounced. A lab accident is what Whitgift's people have been told. Everything would be hushed up, Mike reflected bitterly. Only he would be left to face the music. Tears of fear and pain and shame brimmed in his eyes. Finally, Holmes, we come to you. The dean's deep funereal tones made Mike quiver. I, at least, do give credence to your protestations of innocence and disinterested affection. That your scientific enthusiasms blinded you to the proprieties is understandable in view of your extreme youth and precocity. However, your situation is far more parlous than that of Mundford. You smuggled this monstrous machine into your college rooms, where it was cavorting unclothed. Your physical familiarities with the creature were seen to pass well beyond those of mere repair and refurbishment. And consider further, a male soul in a female eidolon, an automaton crafted to look like a 12-year-old girl, but with the skills of a doxy. This is undeniable depravity, sir. Tears rolled down Mike's cheeks. Unchecked, the dean's reasoning was unimpeachable and flowed naturally into the peroration. You must now take the very greatest care, young Holmes. Walk henceforward in the paths of light, at best a stench of Byronic excesses with underaged females will forever cling to the name of Mycroft Holmes. At worst, well, you are in peril of foreign exile, or, I hesitate to even suggest it, prison. Mundford has only been saved by the influence of his uncle, Admiral Dagton. He will join the Navy as soon as his injuries permit. You can bring no such persuasion to bear. Your next error will surely lead to your utter destruction and downfall. Therefore, I suggest a period of rustication. Your broken leg will account for your absence for the rest of this year. Do not feel you need to return until Easter term if your medical needs dictate a longer recuperative period. Use this time prudently, lad. Once they remove that cast, cold shower baths and long country walks will have an ameliorative effect upon the animal spirits. Muse upon the duties you owe to your creator and your queen. Fortify yourself with daily scripture reading, particularly the epistles. Reflect upon the example you are setting for your younger brother. There is a Holmes minor, am I correct? And repent. I will, sir. It took all of Mike's strength to keep from sobbing out loud. This will never happen again. How to ensure this? With all his heart, he yearned for a way to signal to one and all that he was done with women. There was no use taking orders in the Church of England with its married clergy. An eremitical sect in the Syrian desert, perhaps. Dismissed at last, Mike hobbled painfully across the quad. The blackened ruins of his old rooms were covered now by canvas sheeting, pending new roofing. Nobody spoke to him until he passed the buttery. Erasmus was just coming out with a tray of fragrant meat pies. "Now then, young master," the mechanical servitor said, "you look like you could do with some feeding. It was one of the lines from Erasmus's data cards. But even an automated kindness brought tears to Mike's eyes again, and a new thought. Thank you, Erasmus. I could. In fact, could you spare four? And that's the end.
For my fallen state, purchased as they were at such an awful cost. Bracelets, lavaliers, can they dry my tears? Can they blind my eyes to shame? Can the brightest brooch shield me from reproach? Can the purest diamond purify my name? And yet, of course, these trinkets are endearing. Ha-ha! I'm awesome that my sapphire is a star. Ha-ha! I rather like a 20-carat earring. Ha-ha! If I'm not pure, at least my jewels are. Enough! I'll take their diamond necklace and show my noble stuff by being reckless.
Everybody should be a great cook, but the best cook of all is Barbara Cook. Glitter and Be Gay from Candide by Leonard Bernstein with thousands of librettists. I'm not sure who wrote the libretto for that particular song. Every song had a different, Dorothy Parker worked on this. Lillian Hellman, mm. Sondheim,
everybody.
Everybody was in Candide. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Brenda Clough, who just read this wonderful... I know all short stories have Mycroft Holmes and sex bots, but you know, this is one of the thousands that follow that trope. It was fun.
And as the idea of a 15-year-old Mycroft Holmes discovering his true self, you know, this is always fun, you know. How did he get to be the man we see in, you know, the Greek Interpreter and the other Holmes stories, you know.
And then the forthcoming, I shouldn't give anything away. I won't. Spoilers. As Stephen Moffat would write, spoilers. But all I can say is when it comes to PBS sometime in the next year, look for Sherlock, written by Stephen Moffat with Martin Freeman as Watson. And I forget the name of the amazing fellow who plays Watson. He's basically Doctor Who. And think of Moriarty as the master. It's basically what it is. And well worth catching. That was wonderful, Brenda.
Thank you.
Now let's see. Do you want to I'm glad we have a half hour to go. Do you want to chat? Do you want to invite others to ask questions?
Up to you. Do you have callers here?
Already, yes. I'm always suspicious when two men... Oh, and we wanted to do a giveaway, didn't we?
Oh, well, we do have giveaway. We do indeed.
Yeah, okay. So what we'll have to... Because we're going to have to do the giveaway during a song. So why don't we... should we do the giveaway first and then take phone calls? Why don't, I think that will be the better way. So I will find another bit of music. And why don't you describe what it is we're going to give away, and then we'll take a call at random.
Well, it's going to be a listener choice. I can get you an ebook, and if it would be a Revise the World, and then you'd have to let me know what format you want your ebook in. We can do PDF, Mobi, and a whole bunch of...
Do you have EPUB?
You have to go over and look at the Book View Cafe to see the different versions that are available, because I sure don't know. I can't remember them all. It's complex. Or maybe it would be better...
It is EPUB, and that one's sort of universal.
Right. And the other thing that you could have is, assuming you do not do e-books at all, you just can't handle this, I can send you a hardback autographed copy of How Like a God, which is came out from Tor Books, then, if you want an ebook, you have to send me an email address. But if you want a hardback novel, then you need to get me a snail mail address so that I can mail it to you through the U.S. mails. So it really is depends on, I guess, on how much of a Luddite you really are. There are people who are major ebook fans. And I will say that Revise the World is not available in any other form than E at this moment. So you either have to hop over and read it chapter by chapter on the website, or you can win it, and I'll email it to you as an attached file.
I'm sitting here with my little Murph computer in front of me, and this can do ebooks and all kinds of stuff. I like books.
Well,
even non-Kindle. I like the Kindle. I like all this stuff, but you know.
I am waiting for the next generation of and I can see that pretty soon that they will come. You know how GPSs, they've progressed so amazingly in just like a decade.
Within a year, you'll have color.
I am waiting.
You're thinking of digital ink as opposed to backward.
I'm a trailing edge person, so I'm waiting for it to get to be where it's just so super I can't resist. And the other thing I'm waiting for.
I would say we're halfway there.
The other thing that it really depends on is what you need your ebook for. I have traveled around the world like carrying a suitcase full of books in case I should run. When I went to Beijing, I was careful to buy paperbacks that I knew that I didn't need to keep so I could shed them as I crossed the country, you know, leaving them in hotel rooms to baffle the maids in rural China. But then if I had to do that again, I would buy a Kindle or whatever, and I would load on vast, huge.
Yeah.
That's what you are going to do.
Traveling.
If you were going to travel, then instead of carrying a billion heavy books, you would carry one device with everything that you could possibly read for 5 years on it, and you would be a happy camper as long as you had electricity to charge that thing. You would be all right. And so it really depends. If I should ever have to do something like go somewhere far away for a long time, I would invest. But otherwise, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait for the trailing edge to really catch up. It needs to be so wonderful. It sweeps me off my feet.
Okay, so people have a choice between a virtual version of Revise the World or a physical version of...
How Like a God.
How Like a God from Tor Books. Okay, so now, do you have a pen on you?
I do
or
not.
A pencil? Ooh, okay.
Somebody must, though.
Well... You'd think in a radio station, but, you know, then we're talkers, not... well, you know what? I can use the computer to take down the information.
Email.
No, that doesn't work.
Oh, okay. Well, do whatever you want to do.
No, I'll... Okay. So what we will do is we will play another cut of music. The music has nothing to do with anything, just another Broadway show. And during that song, I will take a call at random.
Mm.
And don't call yet, because you will not get into the system if you call now. I will tell you the phone number. It's 212-209-2900. And, oh, let me get the software up that I'm going to need. Here we are, Google Docs, and start, create new document. There we go. And then in this, I can type down the information that I will get from people, and we will fulfill that. So how many? Two? One? Is one? What are we giving away?
One book.
One book. Okay, very good. So one lucky person during the start calling after the music starts. If you call before the music starts, I'm not going to take that call, all right? So it's 212-209-2900 for a free copy of either Revise the World or an e-copy, a virtual copy of Revise the World or a physical copy of How Like a God. Those are the choices. So we're going to play a cut of music, and you may commence.
Whenever I'm from time to time depressed, and a trauma wells and swells within my breast, I find some pride deep inside of me as I fondly walk the lane of memory. I see Bonaparte, a mean one, if ever I've seen one, and Nero fiddling through that lovely blaze. Antoinette, dainty queen, with her quaint guillotine. Yeah, those were the good old days. I see Indians dragging an empty covered wagon when scalping the settlers was the latest craze. And that glorious morn, Jack the Ripper was born. Yeah, those were the good old days. I'd sit in my rocking chair, peacefully rocking there, counting my blessings by the score. The rack was in fashion, the plagues were my passion, each day held a new joy in store. Was anybody happy? I see cannibals munching a missionary luncheon. The years may have flown, but the memory stays, like the hopes that were dashed when the stock market crashed. Yeah, those were the good old days. I'd walk a million miles or more for some of the gore of those good old days.
Ray Walston. I mean, come on, Ray Walston. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Brenda Clough. And yes, we have a lucky winner who is taking the virtual book. And LT from Manhattan.
Wonderful.
I didn't ask his permission for the name, but I'll get the initials. One doesn't need. There's probably more than one person with those initials in Manhattan. Just maybe. Anyway, that was cool.
Congratulations.
Yes.
That's good.
And now, if you would like to speak with Brenda Clough about her work in writing, you are still invited to call that same phone number, 212-209-2900. And we'll take calls shortly. Oh, yes, and I was going to repeat that next week on this program, our guest, Owen Simon, you should enjoy the return of Barry Malzberg.
Hey!
Yeah, and he's certainly looking...
Cross again.
He's looking forward to seeing you.
I feel honored.
Yeah, he's a regular listener of yours, you know that.
I am honored. I no longer feel honored. I am honored.
Oh, there you go. And by the way, speaking of Simon Locley's show, Red Wind. No, that's not because he ate something. That's a Raymond Chandler short story. Novella, really.
Yeah,
it's a novella. It is one of my favorite Philip Marlowe stories.
A classic, right?
It is an absolute classic. It's possibly one of the very few Philip Marlowe pieces that has not been made into a movie.
Why is that?
I don't know, Simon. Why is that? I don't have an idea. It would make a great
movie. I mean, there's nothing that's not suitable to turning it into a movie.
No, it's just that, you know, they remake certain Marlowe things over and over and over again. They've done The Big Sleep at least twice. They've done Murder, My Lovely twice. Farewell, My Lovely as Murder, My Sweet and Farewell, My Lovely at least twice. But no, there's Red Wind has never been made. The High Window has been made as a movie called Marlowe with James Garner. I can go on and on and on, but Red Wind has never been made into a movie.
You wonder then whether the rights for some reason are tied up, you know, the estate or anything like that.
No, it's all...
You just wonder.
I mean, the rights for any other Raymond Chandler is available.
Well, you never know. You know, sometimes funny things happen with individual rights, depending on where it was first published.
If
you know, somebody somewhere has got the rights like this, and then you can't. In other words, it's legal. It's tied up in legal.
If somebody wants to pay enough to the Chandler estate, I've never heard of anybody not doing a Philip Marlowe
and making money.
And you know, they even allowed. What's his name, who just recently passed away, who finished Poodle Springs, who wrote the last Philip Marlowe novel.
Robert Parker.
They allowed him to finish a Philip Marlowe novel. I mean, the rights are available. People can do what they will with that British aristocrat.
Well, when I get that big fat letter from the lawyer's office next week.
Ah, then we'll know who holds the rights.
Okay. There we go. Well, there you go.
At any rate, stay tuned for three shows in a row on As I Please with Raymond Chandler. I cannot imagine a more fun way to spend a Saturday morning. Other than listening to my show and talking to Brenda Clough, which we will do now. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello,
you're on the air.
Hey, hate to be in the department of, like, you're always wrong. I always seem to be, like, contradicting you. I am holding in my hand very fine season one of Philip Marlowe, made on HBO or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what episode six is? Red Wind.
Okay, so who...
It's a very good, very good
HBO,
stuff.
You say.
Okay, so...
I don't know, some cable station in the 80s. It has Powers Booth. It's a very good Philip
Okay,
Marlowe.
That he was very good. Yeah.
Red Wind.
So but it's still not a movie. It's not a movie though.
It's like a movie.
Yeah,
it's done very well, like in the Chinatown kind of, like, you know, they got all the...
No, I mean, you're right and I'm right. They've still never made a movie. That's a TV series.
Well, you got to see it to believe it.
But it's
very good, and I recommend it to... I mean, I'm a big Marlowe fan. And
is it also on Netflix? Is it the kind of thing you can get on Netflix? Because you
got it. Oh, what was it? I don't know if I want to give them a plug.
Go ahead.
I don't know what they are. Hold on. Because I got the catalog and I threw it out. They sent me so many catalogs. It's, here we go. Oldies.com.
Okay.
And I know they had some copies. And they sent it very fast.
I'm going to have to get it. Because first of all, I thought Powers Booth was an excellent Marlowe.
Love the guy. Well, as soon as I fell in love with not only like the depiction of Marlowe, but Powers Booth as well.
Yeah.
Also, can I give a weirdo science fiction recommendation?
Please.
Okay. You know, and I usually hate vanity you know what I'm saying? A vanity piece.
Mm-hmm.
And this is with I had a girlfriend. I used to call him Anthony Pumpkin, but it's Anthony Perkins. Not Anthony Perkins.
No,
the guy that was like Silence of the Lambs guy, which I hated. There's a movie called Slipstream.
Hmm.
So he wrote and directed it. And it's like it has a science fiction element. I won't get into it. It actually raves about Invasion of the Body Snatchers and how everyone's an alien. And it's about a guy kind of like in a Slaughterhouse Five type of version, is like losing his mind, but maybe not, and kind of like going through different time frames of different realities or something like that. And it's done in a slip-cut style. It's, like, actually very, very good, because I usually would hate, like, a big actor writing and directing his own movie, like, gee whiz, but this is really good. And it has a science fiction element, and I recommend it.
It sounds interesting.
Along with Saragossa Manuscript, which you probably still haven't seen. You can find a copy of.
I'm sorry, which?
It's called Saragossa Manuscript. That... Don't ask me to pronounce the director.
Okay.
It's like a Polish... It's a three-hour black and white 1960s... I think it was like worshipped by Jerry Garcia and like restored or something. So it's
if you
very,
have enough drugs, anything looks great.
No, it's very hallucinogenic. It's very...
I tend to like
mystical and like
movies.
is reality here or something, and it goes into different stories at different times, and you really lose your mind watching it. And I don't recommend watching it if you're tired, because there's a lot of philosophy in there. So, very good movie. It's probably still out of print.
Cool.
Dance with the Devil, too, with Xavier Badim and Rosie.
That
Perez.
One I've heard of, actually.
I was just recommending it to somebody, and it went out of print. You might still find a copy somewhere. That's I like Xavier Badim in it. That's when I was introduced to him. And then I saw No Country for Old Men, and I didn't like the haircut. You know, he has
yeah,
much
right.
cooler haircut in this movie.
But that's sort of the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, sorry to... You know
yeah, we're a little off topic, so...
But do you know how many times I've corrected you? I mean, I just have to say, you know?
Hey, I'm not perfect,
remember
but I will stand by
the... I'd just like to tell the lady...
Brenda Clough.
This is a man who mistook Chris Rock for the other Chris that won't be named.
I don't care if I mistake Chris Rock for Miss Tucker for Chris Tucker because I don't. How's that? And furthermore, I stand by my statement, Red Wind has never been made into a movie.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't, but it's
well,
not
these are,
okay,
let me explain.
A
these
TV.
Are cable,
okay,
like,
look, first of all, we're off topic. The topic this morning is Brenda Clough, okay? I don't mind discussing and arguing with you, but it's not the topic for this morning. And secondly, a TV show is not a movie, bottom line. I do appreciate the call, but we're going to move on because we only have 10 minutes left. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
I knew there was a reason I took an earlier London flight yesterday. This is wonderful. Sex bots in Zeppelins? Almost sounds as interesting as a comic tale about a Colorado cannibal. Well, anyway, Brenda, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Now, I have to tell you, first of all, did you know that you have the same last name, if in fact you spell it C-L-O-U-G-H, which I think I heard right, as a character in an old British ballad?
Possibly, you know, it's an old British name, and I married into it because I'm neither old nor British.
Well, the name of the ballad is Adam Bell, Clym of the Claw, Clough, and William Cloudsley. It is in Child, number 116. Anyway, but let me ask you about your steampunk. Oh, by the way, listen, in the early 70s...
We are short on time.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you a story about Asian trying to conquer England. Who's the hero, Dennis Nayland Smith?
You know, I'm trying to remember exactly how we worked this.
I was thinking of
oh,
that
you know who
you
was the hero?
That, yeah.
Who was the hero?
George
I don't know if you've listened, you've read Great Expectations,
yes.
And the detective in Great Expectations, and now his name slips my mind because it's too early in the morning. He was helping Esther Summerson, and finally he discovers her mother, and they track the mother through London, and she's discovered dead on the grave. Anyway, it is that guy whose name now slips my mind because it's so early in the morning.
Is that Great Expectations or that Bleak House?
Bleak House. You're right.
Bleak
it is
House.
Bleak House.
Inspector Bucket.
Inspector Bucket. There
yeah,
you
Bucket.
Are. I had to use Inspector Bucket, and yeah. So the great Inspector Bucket saves England.
Ooh.
Or tries to save
well,
England.
Well, it could have been worse. It could have been Inspector Gadget. But anyway, the point is, I don't think there was a detective in Great Expectations. One quick question. In your steampunk anthology, are any of them set in my favorite historical period, a.k.a. Civil War frontier?
You know, we're talking about doing that. And if we do that, I have a thought. And my thought revolves around Little Women. You remember that? In Little Women,
yes.
Amy goes to Europe and with the Mr. Lawrence and Theodore Lawrence, the son. And the young Lawrence reforms, and instead of being in love with Joe, he finally marries Amy. Something happens in there to that kid, okay? And my idea is the reason, where did Mr. Lawrence make all that money? You know, he's the rich neighbor.
That's right.
Science. Robots, man. And you know, I am convinced that young Lawrence died in an unfortunate accident in Europe. And Mr. Lawrence had to bring him back in a slightly more mechanical format. He's different, okay, now? And so now, of course, one sister, just shift from one sister to the other. Perfectly easy if you're being rebooted, you know. Someone pushes Control-Alt-Delete on that kid.
I want to see you do one where the bank at Coffeyville or the two banks that the Daltons tried to rob in 1892 were done by robots.
Or, we're going to have to toy with this.
Or Custer at Little Bighorn with Zeppelins.
You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of the opening of Toy Story 3. Do you remember that?
When
the train, and then suddenly Buzz Lightyear is there and saving the spaceship. It is so great.
All right.
So, yeah, we could do this. We're going to work on this one.
I hope so. Have
okay.
a good day.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. By the way, I've looked up and Slipstream, thank you for that first caller, is written by, of all people, Anthony Hopkins.
Ooh, okay.
Fine right. actor. I didn't know that. Written, scored, and starring... Written, scored, and directed by Anthony Hopkins. It sounds like an interesting
versatile
movie.
Man.
Yeah, very much so. With fava beans. Good morning. You're on WBAI.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
How are you? Really enjoyed the story. I'm going to be doing a lot of lying. I am going to tell everyone I tell about the story that I knew who he was as soon as you mentioned younger brother.
Oh, good, because you know you have to sort of hint around at this, and I actually squeezed in as much Holmesian reference without actually saying his name for as much
as the
mouse-colored dressing gown.
I think if you knew who it was sheer luck.
Yeah, but no, it was the mouse-colored dressing gown, Baritsu, you know. I think everyone who's seriously Holmesy will recognize it, but not perhaps everybody.
If it wasn't Sherlock, it certainly wasn't my craftiness.
Oh, okay. So you've become a Holmes pun philosopher.
Well, that's the danger of too many annotated editions. Jim, there was one just semi-relevant thing. I had a pledge during the last drive, and apparently it was never taken off of my card. Who did I contact at the station about that?
Well, the subs department, but if you can email me...
No, I can't. I might be able to get somebody else to. But
or if you can write me, can you do
that? I can do.
Okay, if you can write me, Jim Freund, care of WBAI, it's Freund, care of WBAI, I almost said 505, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. I will see that it gets to the right people.
Okay, that's great. That's excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you for the story and fun morning. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Telephone number here, WBAI, although we have like 3 minutes left, is 212-209-2900. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. All right. Unfortunately, I missed out on the story and so much things. So, of course, what I'm going to do is stay completely on target and ask about the author and some of her works and if she's going to do any other readings because, of course, again, I did miss their first reading, but just because I'm interested in the literature that you do.
Well, I'm going to be at Capclave. I guess it's in October, right?
Capclave is the second week in October.
And that's near Washington, D.C. It's in Rockville, Maryland, I believe. And I guess I'm going to be reading there. I signed up for something. I don't remember.
And
now
I will
it is.
Be there.
Yeah, so that's something that we're going to be doing. And I'm trying to think of the usual. I usually go to the conventions in the Washington area, so Balticon over Memorial Day weekend. I may actually show up next year. This year's Worldcon is in Australia, and obviously I'm not there.
It started yesterday.
Right, but I'm thinking about going to Reno next year if I can manage it. And because it won't be so costly and difficult, to, you know, Australia, let's face it, is far.
It's going to be in Reno next year?
So I'm informed. Am I correct?
I think that's the case.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Wow.
I stopped going to WorldCon a few years ago.
But Reno is doable.
It is doable.
Yeah. And so I need to think this thought carefully here. But I might do that. And in that case, a bunches of interesting things will occur. I don't checked out.
I was actually born in Australia, but that would be quite a trek to do. And
well, it's too late now.
Just for WorldCon. And yes, as mentioned, it started yesterday.
It ends, you've already missed it. And
it ends Monday. So.
Yeah, they're having the Hugo Awards even now as we speak, probably.
That seems about right. So they're probably happening.
Yeah,
right
and so
now.
What it really means is that you should not try to do it at this point because it's
there
too late.
Go.
But next year, it's a possibility. And
I support the regional conventions, actually.
Yeah, up and down the East Coast, there's
my
so
favorite
many great
is ReaderCon.
Ones. ReaderCon is a wonderful convention, although I haven't been in several years. For a period of time when I was doing college tours with the kids, I would go to all these conventions, shovel the family off to colleges to tour them while I went to the conventions. But then after that, all the money was sucked out by the
okay,
colleges
we have
themselves.
2 minutes left, so what you should do is tell people how they can find you online and things like that.
Well, I have a lot of my work is up at bookviewcafe.com, including an entire novel, serialized, and a number of short stories in one way or another.
And let us be explicit, that is BookViewCafe.com. Book View Cafe, a wonderful site,
and
a collective of people.
On my own website, which is Brenda, it's www.sff.net/Brenda. But all you
that's
have to
actually /people/Brenda. You know
oh, okay.
what?
Okay. Google on my name, and I am the first 300 hits that click up if you put my
okay,
name
let's
into Google.
Get that Brenda and
Clough, C L O U G H. I'm the first 300 hits that kick up.
C L O U G H.
Brenda.
And in fact, if you make it Brenda W. Clough,
yes.
You can see our Wikipedia entry.
My Lord. I am the first 300 hits that kick up. It's very hard to find another Brenda Clough on this planet because I dominate world Google. But on my webpage, I think there's some fiction. There's also, I believe, a link to me reading a story out loud, a really scary story. It is. It's a story that I read at Halloween for Capclave either last year or the year before. And it is truly scary. Scares the pants off of everybody.
Now, are you?
It's a pregnancy horror story.
A pregnancy horror. Are you? Were you a straight literature person, or were you a historian?
Been a writer for. I think I've been writing since my first novel came out in like 1984. So I've been around for a while, but it's but doing this and that and the other thing as well. So it's I do actually quite a wide variety of stuff, but I mainly write novels and short stories in the genre here.
Yeah, and at some point we'll have to talk more. You'll come back and we'll talk about your schooling. You went to school in Laos.
Well, I have lived.
Am I reading that correctly?
I'm a State Department brat, so I have lived in very, very large number of fairly exotic places, and so I've done quite a number of different things, and so, you know, there's just a real variety of stuff. Anyway, my full bibliography is up on my webpage. There's all these links and stuff.
And your current, actual, hard copy book that's out now is called what?
Well, I have all my hard copy stuff you can buy on Amazon.com or whatever.
But the latest book is e-book called Revise the World. We are out of time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, bye-bye. Brenda, it has been wonderful having you here.
Oh, it's been so great to come up here with you.
The time flies.
It does. What happened? 2 hours, it's gone.
Yeah, it's
heartbeat.
Yeah, exactly. But a wonderful reading, a wonderful show, and thank you again. So
thank you so much for having me.
So once more, for everybody listening, it's Clough, Brenda Clough. Also, don't forget, this Tuesday, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings commence with John Langan and Sarah Langan. You want to know more information, write jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and I'll send you the information. Stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Locally, Raymond Chandler, and Red Wind.
Yay.
And next week, my guest will be Barry N. Molesberg. Take care and enjoy yourselves. Good morning.
Oh, Well, now, you are tuned to WBAI New York City 99.5 on your FM dial. Listener sponsored, approximately non-commercial, the radio station that squeaks your language, WBAI. And good morning and welcome to As I Please for this, the fourth day of September in the year 10. And goodness gracious, but there was a dramatic sky overhead last night as I was preparing to turn in, which, for those who are so anxious to know every little detail of this protracted misery known as my life, on Fridays I turn in around 7:30 or so. But I decided I would just take a little peek out, because all day long, you know, and all week long, we'd been hearing, "Earls are coming, Earls are coming, Earls are coming our way." And so I looked out, and looking to the west, it was a lovely sunset. The sky was dark with streaks of a very bright magenta hue with patches of blue. And I said to myself, that's what I said to myself in those exact words. Then I walked to the other side of the house and took the eastern view. And there, storm clouds over the horizon, dark, brewing a storm that had come all the way from the, well, from very, very far away. It had been in North Carolina earlier that day. But, you know, I'll tell you something. I mean, you know, I now know an awful lot about New York City weather because I'm exposed to it so often. And I have always had a sort of a little interest in the idea of saying, maybe I'll just chuck this highbrow crapola and just become a good old-fashioned TV weatherman, because you don't really have to work that hard. You know, come summer, and I would like to get my job as a TV weatherman starting in summer, because it's very easy. Every day from May right on through September, you are fairly accurate if you say, "And the weather for today is hazy, hot, and humid, with a chance of showers in the afternoon." And then while I'm working that out and during the summer, pointing to maps and so on, I could study up so I could give you good forecasts regarding winter storms. But I'll tell you, right, that's neither here nor there. I don't want to bore you with that sort of stinking detail. What I do want to say is that I knew when I stuck my head out the window that there was nothing happening, nothing coming our way. And I'll tell you how I knew. The nose. That's right. When a hurricane hits New York, in the hours beforehand, in that warm, storm-laden breeze, you can smell the tropics. It is a really fantastic experience. You know that this weather front has been coming for a long time, barreling up the coast of the United States, hitting North Carolina, hitting Jersey, getting ready to... But there was none of that tropical aroma in the air. Well, I do appreciate a good storm, but I do not appreciate the worrywartism, as we might call it, because everyone was saying, "Oh, you know, you really got to buckle down." Oh, you know, people were saying, "Oh, should I tape up my windows? Or let's bring in everything." Nah, it was quite the disappointment. Ah, well, that's the way it is on this earth, and, you know, we can only hope for better luck next time. What's the next tropical storm heading our way? Fanny, I believe its name is. So, come on, Fanny, hit New York. We will welcome you with open arms. I don't know whether you heard about the Lee ultimatum. It was one of those stories that got a little bit of coverage on the day of the event and then has been pretty much covered up by the succeeding waves of trivia that passes for news. The Lee ultimatum. A man out in Silver Springs, Maryland, took over an office at the Discovery Channel, held hostages, and claimed that he was a human bomb. Boom, 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 boom. And he was there for much of the day, and I understand that this tied up traffic all around Washington, D.C., and of course, take that, Washington, D.C. But then the authorities heard a shot, and if you did not hear the upshot of the story, Mr. James Lee is now bereft of life. He is a dead protester. But it was indeed this protest that sparked my interest. You know, there are lunatics and there are lunatics. But his particular mission was to uncover the truth about the Discovery Channel. Now, on the whole, I would say, gee, the Discovery Channel, that seems to me rather benign, you know? I mean, they talk about the National Geographic stuff and, you know, around the world and cooking shows, you know. But this guy had a sense that even the minutest acceptance of what the Discovery Channel was doing would lead to, well, the end of the world, which, surprisingly enough, he was in favor of. His complaint is that, you know, the Discovery Channel is not spending enough time on the topic of birth control. Now, I'm going to tell you something. In the newspaper account that I read of this, they did give me the web page, and I went there and I downloaded it, and I have it here with me. But I am not going to give you that information, and I'll tell you why. Because once you see that it's online, you will believe it, and you will become a convert to this loon. Now, of course, that's a real question, and it's a real problem around the world. At what point does a simple protest enter the realm of lunacy? Well, as soon as you display the fact that you have absolutely no comprehension at all of the simplest rules of grammar. Oh, I know you're saying, how can you say that? A man had a passion, he had a belief. Grammar shouldn't count for two bits about what he felt, about what he wanted to say. Well, yes, if it was a conversation, we wouldn't know about his bad spelling. But when you post it online and you encourage people to consult this particular web page, I think it behooves you to take good care to make sure your spelling is right and that you have no participles dangling at odd places. And Mr. Lee failed on that account. He also failed to persuade me to the underlying evil of the Discovery Channel, although, on the whole, I cannot disagree with his notion that, to quote from his manifesto, what about human beings? The world don't need humans. And so he made his first step towards that. Now, there's a program on television called Life After People, or Earth After People, which I find actually strangely encouraging, strangely comforting. You know, it gives you a sense of, if humanity were to disappear like that, how long would it take for the world to restore itself to its natural balance? And you'll be pleased to know, a lot sooner than you might expect. I think the Brooklyn Bridge might last another 80 years if there weren't human caretakers dealing with it. As a matter of fact, shockingly enough, were humanity to disappear tomorrow, crossing fingers and knocking on wood, if humanity were to disappear entirely tomorrow, in 1,000 years, there would probably still be Mount Rushmore. Who's the guy with the spectacles? Why, that was Theodore Roosevelt, a great president of the United States years and years ago. Well, how would they know? They wouldn't. It would be it must be four great gods. Well, in any case. So, I began reading up on this guy out of this sort of morbid curiosity for what I can only say is, no matter what his justice might be, whatever the justice of his cause, there is no call to be going around and shooting up people or threatening to shoot up people. Certainly not when you're just talking about a programming issue, which, of course, brings it all back home because, you know, there are a lot of people here within the station who believe that programming decisions should be decided entirely by the amount of protest and in the front of the building. And you say to yourself, well, you know, that's interesting. It's an interesting notion, but it's no way to run a radio station or a television station. Well, a couple of years ago, Mr. Lee was outside of the... He's been harping on this topic for a while. So Mr. Lee was outside the Discovery Channel headquarters in Silver Spring, Maryland. I believe that's where it is, in any case. And he had a protest there. And he's got picket signs and pamphlets and so on. And in the course of this, and you might want to write this day, February 2008, his protest was to throw... Dig this, comrades, dig this. He threw $20,000 into the air. And, of course, the crowd went wild scrambling to get their dollar bills. Now, a man who has $20,000 to literally throw away. Well, all I could say is that for $20,000, he could probably have bought a program on Pacifica. Hey, I'm not suggesting that that is the usual standard or course of behavior, but I bet it's possible. $20,000 right up in the air as a protest against the Discovery Channel's hidden agenda of supporting war and the production of more human beings. Well, that is the issue. Somewhere along the line, that little notion of a wrong warped his thinking. And you know, clearly wasn't thinking too well to begin with because his grammar shows it. I'm sorry, but that's what it... Now, let me just say this. You know, you'll probably say, what about Huckleberry Finn? That's a different thing. That's a novel. But when you are just sitting around talking, you know, we don't care about spelling or grammar when we're just sitting around talking. But when you take that step to publish, to make a public statement, to enter the arena with the arts of persuasion behind you, I do believe it behooves you to take a little care about how the words hang together. And alas, Mr. Lee seemed to have no interest in that. That was just taking him away from his important mission, which ultimately led to his death. Yes, talk is cheap. Syntax is all. And yet, his passion is real enough. One can certainly understand where he is coming from as such. And yet, that passion took him to the loony side of the equation. And you almost feel sort of sorry for him. You know, you just say maybe if he had had a course of antidepressants, or maybe if he got himself a motorcycle or something, just something to distract him from that obsession, that one great thing. And if we resolve this, all other problems will fade. Well, that's always very nice. And the problem, of course, is that, you know, everyone sort of has that notion that, you know, if we could just take care of this, everything else will just fall into place. And yet, well, we are still dealing with humans. And, well, there's the problem now. Well, what can I say? James J. Lee, a man too passionate, too overwrought by his idea, to recognize that his idea, with its soupçon of justice, had lost the ability